The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power by Robert A. Caro, Part 2, continued. Creating a staff proved easier than creating a program. Directives from NYA headquarters in Washington mandated the creation of 12,000 public work jobs for young Texans. Lyndon Johnson's only experience with public works had been his job on a highway department road gang in Johnson City. Now he had to create out of nothing, a public works program huge in size and statewide in scope. And once it was created, he had to direct it, to manage it, to administer it. His only administrative experience was his work as Clayburgh's secretary. The only staff he had previously directed, this 26-year-old who would now be directing scores of men, had consisted of Gene Latimer, L.E. Jones, and Russell Brown. Complicating the problems of all 48 state directors was the strictness of the criteria by which NYA headquarters in Washington would determine the acceptability of proposed work projects. To avoid displacement of adult workers, for example, the projects could not involve work that would otherwise be undertaken by state or local government. To ensure that the limited NYA funds went primarily to young people rather than to contractors or suppliers, NYA Bulletin No. 11 required that 75% of project allocations be spent on wages. This requirement reduced the amount that could be spent on the materials and equipment essential for work projects to an unrealistically low level. Complicating the state director's problems further was the lack of guidance from Washington. Recalls one director, when we asked Washington what kind of work, we were told, "That's up to you." But we didn't know. We couldn't possibly have known what kind of work these youths wanted or needed. Complicating the problems of the Texas NYA director, the youngest of the 48 directors and one of the few without public works or administrative experience, was the factor that complicated every problem in Texas, its vast size. Every attempt to establish a statewide public works program in Texas had been hamstrung by the variations in climatic, cultural, social, and economic conditions in a state 800 miles from top to bottom and almost 800 miles wide. A state that, had it been located in the east, would have covered all the states of New England, as well as New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and West Virginia. Since, moreover, the state was divided into 254 counties, public works programs could not feasibly be planned on a county-by-county basis, as would be possible in other states. Nibbling at the problem would not solve it. A statewide program, one applicable to all counties and unaffected by sectional variations, was what was needed. Lyndon Johnson had to find a public works project that no one else had thought of, that required only minuscule expenditures on the materials and equipment that normally were staples of public works projects, and that had huge, sweeping, statewide scope. It was while discussing Lyndon Johnson's early days with the NYA that his wife first told this author, "Lyndon was not the supremely confident person he seemed, you know." L.E. Jones, who had returned to Austin but worked part-time for the NYA for a few weeks, says, "They had to spend the money and they had to do it fast. This was a decision that Lyndon had to make. Making the decision was hard. I remember the interminable wrangling over what's going to be our first project. They just couldn't decide. Everybody had a different idea." Finally, after weeks of discussion, someone, no one remembers who, hit on the idea of building roadside parks, adjoining the state's many new highways, areas of an acre or two that would be leveled and paved with gravel, and in which would be set a few picnic tables, a few benches, and three or four barbecue pits, as well as shrubs and shade trees. Without even comfort stations, by Eastern standards, such small areas would scarcely justify the name of parks. But in barren Texas, where it was possible to drive 100 miles with no place to picnic except the ground, they would be welcome. They would, moreover, improve highway safety. Lack of such facilities had caused accidents because motorists had been forced to park on highway shoulders, or because many highways in Texas were built with only narrow shoulders, or with none at all, on the edge of the roadway itself, while they picnicked or relieved themselves, or on long trips, slept at night. Only a few months before, a family of five had been killed near San Antonio when a car rammed theirs while they were sleeping under it during a rainstorm. The State Highway Department enthusiastically agreed to furnish not only the necessary land and materials, mostly cement and wood for the benches and tables, but also the transportation. Young workers would be taken to each site in departmental trucks. That was an important consideration in so sparsely populated a state. And when the department also agreed to furnish the supervision by departmental foremen, the roadside parks became projects which met fully the NYA's requirement that 75% of the cost go directly for young people's wages. The little parks met as well the criteria peculiar to Texas. Suitable to all climates, they could be built everywhere in the state, and the highway department, a statewide organization, was of course the sponsor. Since the department had had no plans to build such parks, the projects would not displace regular departmental employees. One additional criterion, not referred to in NYA bulletins, remained. For political reasons, as Jones puts it, the project had to not only be good, but look good. It had to be something that would be popular. So important was this to Johnson that he had persuaded Maury Maverick to let him hire his speechwriter, an ex-newspaperman named Herbert C. Henderson, to write up each proposal that had been discussed to see how it sounded. No previous proposal had seemed right, but when Henderson finished writing up this one, Jones says, it turned out to be perfect. When Johnson realized that he had a project at last, his relief could not be contained. He was beside himself with happiness. Jones, the near-perfect typist, had to stay up all night copying Henderson's description to be sent to Washington for official approval. And then, as dawn was breaking over Austin, Johnson walked with Jones to the post office to see with his own eyes that the precious proposal was placed properly in a mailbox. Within a few days, a handful of young men carrying picks and shovels rode out of Austin on a highway department flatbed truck to begin building on Route 8 near Williamson Creek, the first roadside park in Texas. If there had been desperation to find the right program, once they found it, there was desperation to get it underway. Lyndon was like a crazy man, Jones says. He just worked night and day, just worked his staff to distraction. By June 1936, 135 parks would be under construction, and 3,600 youths would be earning $30 per month working on them. Was there something else that made the roadside park an especially attractive idea to Johnson? The project he selected was one, practically the only one possible, in an area of work with which he himself was familiar. He himself, after all, had once been in a group of youths, riding, pick and shovels in hand, in a flatbed department truck out to a creek. His quota, of course, was not 3,600 jobs, but 12,000. Some were created by additional projects connected with the highway department. NYA workers built rural school walks, gravel paths paralleling heavily traveled highways, to encourage children to stay out of the road while walking to school. They trimmed back trees and shrubs to improve visibility at dangerous intersections and curves. They filled in the erosion-caused ditches that lined many Texas highways, and whose slopes were so steep that a car veering even a few feet off the road could overturn in them. And to inhibit future erosion, they built drainage ditches. They graveled the last several hundred feet of dirt roads which intersected paved highways, because when rain turned these roads to mud, cars dragged the mud onto the highways and made them slippery. They built graveled turnouts by farmers' mailboxes, in areas where mailmen had created a traffic hazard when they stopped their cars on the pavement. These were small projects, even smaller than the roadside parks, but they would furnish another 2,800 jobs. To create more jobs, local projects, projects involving only a single town, were necessary. As with the highway department projects, NYA regulations required that the materials and equipment be supplied by an outside sponsor. Johnson asked local officials to suggest improvements they wanted to see made in their towns. In some places, the response was, "We don't want any federal handouts," and in other towns, the small in-group didn't want any innovations that might interfere with its power. One area that particularly resisted the NYA, for example, was Karnak, Lady Bird's hometown, because of Lady Bird's father. Captain Taylor ran things in Karnak, Bill Deason recalls, and in the whole northern end of Harrison County. And he said, "You just stay out of the north end of the county. I'll take care of the folks up here." But such resistance wasn't widespread because most towns were desperate over the plight of their young people. A more serious problem was the lack of initiative and ability to think along new lines. Even if they wanted the federal money, they didn't have any imagination, Deason says. "We tried terrifically not to have any of that leaf-raking that was being criticized so much elsewhere, but so often they didn't have any worthwhile ideas of what projects might be worthwhile to do." Johnson overcame these problems. "Lyndon Johnson had to sell," Bill Deason says, "and I've told you before, he was the greatest salesman I've ever seen. He would say, 'Now, I've got a mission to do, and the money to do it with. Now, you've got to get us a worthwhile program.'" Proposals for local work projects began to be sent into the NYA offices on the sixth floor of the Littlefield building in Austin. Work projects provided income for young men and women who were out of school. The other half of the NYA program was to keep young men and women in school, to provide them with jobs on campus that would allow them to earn enough to continue their education. Implementing the student aid portion of the program required little creativity. The number of students who could be employed in colleges, 12% of the previous year's enrollment, in high schools, 7%, had been set by directives from Washington, as had broad guidelines as to the type of job that would be acceptable and the amount that could be paid. Up to $20 a month for an individual student, although the average payments within a single institution could not exceed $15. But the program required desperate haste. September was approaching. September, when tens of thousands of young Texans would have to drop out of school unless they received help. The NYA state directors had not been appointed until late July. The enrollment and salary quotas had not been issued until August 15th, and these guidelines had to be interpreted state by state and then explained to the college deans and high school principals, who would have to select the jobs that met them. And the size of Texas made explaining more difficult than in other states, even after the NYA allowed Johnson to divide the state into four districts, each with its own district director. "There was still a lot of travel involved," Deason was to recall. "These young district men, directors, we had out there, would maybe be setting up a project in one county seat today and trying to get to another started 100 miles away the same day. He might work until 11:30 in the morning at 1, and just jump in his car and get to the other by 1 or 2 in the afternoon and try to work there." Attempts to make haste were snarled by a human factor, the reluctance of college and high school administrators to decide which students would be given the precious NYA jobs. 12% of their students might be eligible for NYA aid, but a much higher percentage needed such aid. 29,000 college students would apply for the 5,400 jobs available in Texas. Futures, the chance for an education, the chance to get off the farm, hung in the balance on administrators' decisions, and they knew it. Dean Victor I. Moore of the University of Texas, who during the spring term a few months before had dug deep into his own meager savings to keep a few students in school, arrived at the NYA offices with the list of the 761 students he had selected out of more than 3,500 applicants, and as he handed the list to Deason said, "I feel like I have blood on my hands." Shrinking from such decisions, other administrators delayed submitting the necessary lists to the NYA as the precious days passed. Adding to the snarl was red tape. To ensure that student aid would go only to bona fide students, the NYA required that all aid recipients carry at least 75% of the normal academic schedule. Compliance with this requirement had to be certified by the college for each student, and then by the NYA. To ensure that the jobs provided by the college would not deprive adults of work, the NYA required that NYA jobs not be work that could be done out of the regular college budget. To avoid alienating organized labor, pay scales had to be set at the hourly rates for comparable labor in the area. And to avoid criticism that the students were boondoggling, the jobs had to be necessary, not make work. Compliance with these requirements, and with a dozen more, had to be certified. For each student employee, therefore, the college had to fill out long, complicated forms in quadruplicate, so that while the college kept one copy, others would be sent to the state NYA, the WPA, and the State Department of Education. Only after certifications from all three agencies had been received by the Federal Disbursing Office in San Antonio would the desperately needed checks be mailed out. Not to the students, but to the NYA office, which would in turn, under national NYA procedures, distribute them to the colleges, which would in turn distribute them to the students. When dealing with high school students, only students whose families were on relief were eligible. No application could be processed by the NYA until certification of such fact was received from either the Texas Relief Commission or the WPA. Both these agencies, swamped with their own work and believing that it was more important to get heads of families certified for their own programs than to certify students, gave low priority to NYA certifications. And if a form was filled out incorrectly, the WPA would simply return it, often after weeks had passed. The NYA's Washington office added to the confusion by continually issuing new sets of regulations, which often contradicted one another. By late August, many state directors were telling Washington that they could not possibly implement the programs in time for September registration. The NYA's Texas offices had originally been a three-room suite in the seven-story Littlefield Building, one of the tallest buildings in the little city of Austin. Now the NYA office expanded into five rooms, and then six and seven, all crammed with people as the staff expanded and expanded again. The staff was very young. With few exceptions, its members shared two characteristics. They had gone to college at San Marcos, and they had graduated only recently. Of the first 26 men Lyndon Johnson appointed to administrative posts in the Texas NYA, women in the NYA offices worked only as secretaries, 19 were in their 20s. The director, young himself, drove that staff. "He was very nervous," says Ernest Morgan, San Marcos graduate, White Star, 23 years old. "If he wanted you to bring him a letter, he'd be edgy until you brought it." Often he couldn't wait for it to be brought to him. "Tell Morgan to get me that letter," he'd shout through his office door to a secretary, but a moment later the shout would be followed by the shouter. Shoving back his chair, he would jump up from his desk, lunge across the room and out the door, and almost run, with that awkward arms akimbo stride, to Morgan's office and stand there, edgy, while Morgan searched through his files. "He dictated very fast," says one of his secretaries, Mary Henderson. "And while dictating, he just couldn't sit still, striding around the room, acting out the letter, gesticulating with his long arms, jabbing with his forefinger as if making a speech, sometimes, if the phrase he wanted eluded him, waving his arms in the air in a frenzy of frustration. And when he had finished composing an important letter, he couldn't wait to see it on paper. 'Where's that letter? How you doing with that letter, Mary?' Or a secretary transcribing a letter would look up from her typewriter and see him standing there behind her in a corner of the office, staring at the typewriter. 'Everything had to be done now,' says another staff member. And he could get very, very angry if something couldn't be done immediately. Each of thousands of letters, from mayors, county commissioners, school board presidents, college deans, high school principals, students, state and federal officials, was, he ordered, to be answered the day it arrived. In Washington, two typewriters had been at his disposal. Here there were 20, and with 20, as with two, he didn't want those typewriters ever to stop. He didn't want the mimeograph machine to stop either. If, with all available hands busy at other work, he saw the machine standing idle, he would frantically crank the handle himself until dragged away by other business. He didn't want the people to stop. "The nature of the man," says one NYA staffer, "is to think of 100 things for you to do during the day that you can't get done. I don't care what the problem is, he'd start looking at it and he'd start asking questions, and he'll have 50 thoughts and 50 things for you to get done in the next hour, and then he'll take off with his shirt tail flying and leave you to do it. And then," says another, "tomorrow he'd want to know why you didn't get through with it." As he had utilized competition to make two employees work faster in Washington, he used the same spur to make 20 work faster now, telling each man about some other who was working faster. "He would pair us off, or there'd be two or three of us," one recalls. He would work Ray Roberts against Briss, Al Brisbane, or C.P. Little against Fenner Roth. And you were always behind somebody else. He had it down to a fine point. I don't care how hard I worked, I was always behind. The mail descended on their desks in tall stacks, and as the day passed into evening, and the evening drew later, the sight of the stacks, the evidence of work not done, seemed to make him wild. Answering often required telephoning some state agency for information, but Johnson, rushing through the office and seeing a clerk on the telephone, would shout, "God damn it, do you have to spend all your time on the phone?" In his frustration, he sometimes began cursing someone for no apparent reason. Listening to him, I heard every curse word I had ever heard, and some combinations I had never heard, Morgan says. God, he could rip a man up and down. Birdwell, soft-spoken, sweet-tempered, the gentlest man who ever lived, literally cowed before Lyndon Johnson in his rage, stood before him with head lowered and shoulders bent under the lash of Johnson's tongue. Curses were not the only words that hurt. His gift for finding a man's most sensitive point was supplemented by a willingness, eagerness almost, to hammer at that point without mercy. The brilliant Herbert Henderson, for example, had been an alcoholic. Johnson never let him forget it. Another staff member, unable because of the depression to find a job in the United States, had for a time worked at a humiliatingly low-level post in an American company's Peru office. He was ashamed of that fact, and was ashamed also of the $50 per month salary he had been forced to accept in private industry in order to return to Texas. Johnson never let this staffer, or anyone else within earshot, forget these facts. "Why don't you go back to Peru?" he would shout. "Maybe you can get by with work like this there. Why don't you go to China? Why don't I just fire you? Then you can go back to making $50 a month. You know why you were making $50 a month, don't you? Because that's what you're worth." Not all the rage was real. Sometimes, at the height of a tantrum, as Johnson stood screaming, flailing the air with his arms as epithets poured from his contorted mouth, seemingly out of control, an important telephone call would come in. Without a moment's pause, he would pick up the telephone, and his voice would be soft and calm, and, if the caller was important, deferential. Then the call would be over, the phone would be replaced in its cradle, and without a moment's pause the rage would resume. Lyndon Johnson employed curses as he employed competition, for the control of men. Sometimes his treatment of his staff seemed colored by cruelty as much for its own sake as for the sake of the work. Once, rushing by a desk with the mail piled high, he snarled at its occupant in a voice loud enough to be heard by everyone in the room, "I hope your mind's not as messy as that desk." The employee, by desperate effort, succeeded in getting to the bottom of the pile before the next mail arrived, and then wiped off the desk so its clear surface would earn the boss's approval. The boss's reaction? "I hope your mind's not as empty as that desk." The staff would joke about his constant practice of keeping a subordinate whom he had summoned to his office standing before him, often for quite a long time, while he silently studied papers on his desk. And the silence might be preferable to what followed when he deigned to look up. Men who will talk in detail about every other aspect of the NYA days will not discuss what Lyndon Johnson said to them in private. "I'll never tell you that," one man said. "I'll never tell anyone that." All days were work days. There weren't any hours with him. There weren't any days of the week. The days did not include breaks, coffee or otherwise, and lunch was a sandwich at the desk or a hamburger or a bowl of chili hastily gulped at a six-stool cafe downstairs. And the days were often nights as well. On their first evening in the Littlefield building, Johnson, Kellum, Deason, and Birdwell had suddenly been plunged into darkness when the lights in the office went off. Opening the door to the hall, they found the entire building in darkness. Groping his way down the six flights of stairs to the basement, Johnson located the building superintendent, who told him that the generator which supplied the building's electricity was switched off every night promptly at 10 o'clock. By the time Johnson had groped his way back upstairs, however, there were flickers of light in the NYA office. The building's original gas lights, little tubes sticking out of the walls with glass bowls around them, had never been removed, and through some oversight the gas had never been turned off. Kellum had discovered that the lights could be lit with matches. Thereafter, because work in the NYA offices was seldom finished by 10 o'clock, the work was often finished by gaslight. Because the elevators were powered by electricity, the staff became accustomed to feeling their way down the stairs in the dark. Then, emerging onto Congress Avenue, where their cars were parked, they would usually drive not to their homes, but to Johnson's. Half of a small two-frame family dwelling at 4 Happy Hollow Lane, it had a large backyard. It was in that backyard that, in the nights, the work went on. In 1967, during her husband's presidency, Lady Bird Johnson would say that in their marriage, "Lyndon is the leader, Lyndon sets the pattern, I execute what he wants. Lyndon's wishes dominate our household, Lyndon's tastes dominate our household." This pattern antedated the presidency. Lady Bird was not told in advance when her husband would be home or how many guests he would be bringing with him. But no matter how late the hour or how large the number, she was expected to cook them dinner, and she did, with a graciousness and a smile that made them feel at home. Usually the food was gobbled between talk of work. Then, curtly ordering Lady Bird to bring dessert out to them, Lyndon would lead the group into the backyard. The discussions there often concerned the latest bulletin from NYA headquarters in Washington. "That was the hardest thing, to understand the regulations," Deason says. "There was a lot of confusion at the beginning." So in the backyard, by lantern light, Birdwell says, "we would go over those rules and regulations, paragraph by paragraph and page by page. Every paragraph, every page." Lyndon would take this book and he would start reading very carefully, line by line. He would ask us, "Now, what do you all think this means?" And we'd discuss it. "It means so-and-so." Sherman Birdwell had thought he knew his boyhood playmate well, but now he realized he had never seen him at work. He was very, very detailed, far more than I knew Lyndon was. He got down to exactly what Washington was trying to tell us ought to be done and what it meant to us. He wanted things to be absolutely correct. The discussion would be ended not by their exhaustion, but by the subjects. As the hours passed, some of the young men sitting there in the dim light would surreptitiously leaf ahead through the booklet to see how many pages were left, because they knew that Johnson would not let them go home until the last page had been turned. Even after they went home, the work went on, for home for two members of the staff was 4 Happy Hollow Lane. At Johnson's suggestion, Willard Deason and Ellie Jones had rented the Johnsons' spare room. Even after he and Jones had tumbled tiredly into bed, Deason recalls, "we weren't off duty, because he could yell upstairs and say, 'What did you do about this? What did you do about that?' His mind was still working." In the morning, it seemed to begin working the moment he awoke. "When he woke up, he was immediately wide awake," Mrs. Johnson says, "and he was likely to immediately reach for the papers or whatever correspondence he brought home with him from the office." And when, after Lady Bird had brought him, along with the newspaper, coffee in bed, and he had showered and shaved and dressed in the clothes, pen, cigarette lighter, handkerchief, and wallet already in the pockets that she had laid out for him, and in the shoes she had shined, and had tightened the necktie he had left hanging knotted over a doorknob the night before, he ate breakfast with Deason and Jones. He would often say something that made them realize, as Latimer had realized in Washington, that it had gone on working in the dark. Yet the staff didn't feel driven. In part, of course, this was because he had chosen them so well. His selections, men like Kellum, Deason, Roth, and Birdwell, proved everyone to be men who were not only willing to work all day, every day, but who were also willing to take orders and curses without resentment, to be humiliated in front of friends and fellow workers, to see their opinions and suggestions given short shrift. As the staff grew larger, however, its ranks could no longer be filled only from the director's personal acquaintance. He had to hire men he knew slightly or not at all, white stars who had come to San Marcos after he had left, and whom he hired on the recommendation of Fenner Roth or Deason, for example. Some of these new recruits proved unsuitable, but mistakes were rectified. It was during Johnson's tenure as NYA director that there took place the process Deason calls the sifting out. Some new recruits resigned because they weren't willing to work Johnson's hours. There might be a guy in West Texas, 300 or 400 miles from Austin, Deason says. Johnson would say to him, "We're having a meeting Saturday night. Get here 6 o'clock Saturday." That would mean he would work until noon Saturday, then get into a car and drive here, and meet from 6 to 10. And we'd meet again on Sunday, and at 4 o'clock he'd say, "Okay, get home and get started Monday morning." Some men, Deason says, quit because they couldn't go the pace. They just couldn't gear themselves to go Lyndon Johnson's pace, so they just had to fall by the wayside. They didn't make the team, so to speak. Some resigned because they weren't willing to accept Johnson's abuse. As Deason puts it with his usual discretion, Lyndon Johnson pushed and shoved and cajoled, and there were those who could not bear to be pushed and shoved and cajoled. Or if they didn't resign, they were fired. Not by Lyndon Johnson, of course. Deason understood that. He couldn't afford to make enemies. He was looking down the road. But by Deason, he'd say, "So-and-so just can't cut it. Let him go as easy as you can." Lyndon Johnson liked to call a subordinate son, even though the employee might be older than he. He liked a subordinate to call him chief. The recruits who made the team, who survived the sifting out, were, in almost every case, men who allowed this paternalism full scope. Their distinguishing characteristic, in addition to energy and a striking capacity for hard work, was not intelligence. In decades to come, outsiders in Washington or New York who came in contact with these early Johnson men in business or politics, and who assumed from their rank and status a certain level of mental capacity, would be astonished by the reality. Nor was this characteristic dignity or pride. These qualities were, in fact, notably absent in most of these early Johnson men. Their distinguishing characteristic was a remarkable subservience and sycophancy. Observers noted that they seemed to like calling him chief and being called son. Another reason that the staff didn't feel driven was gratitude. Ernest Morgan was from the Hill Country, and he says, "The Depression really hit this area hard. But because it was farm country, food, while not plentiful, was cheap. The job in a cafe near the San Marcos Railroad Station, with which he had worked his way through college, where he had been a debater and a White Star, a 9-hour-a-day, 6-day-a-week job, paid only $5 a week, but it included meals. So he had the luxury of feeling pity for the city people who got off the arriving trains and begged for food. The cafe's owner made a wood pile, and a person who wanted a meal could chop wood for an hour for 25 cents, which was the cost of a one-plate meal. And what was really sad was a father would chop wood, and he'd come in with his wife and 2 kids, and they'd all divide the one plate." But after San Marcos, Morgan went to a city himself, to Austin, to become a lawyer by attending the University of Texas Law School, and learned what hunger was. To earn money, he typed for a professor for $15 a month. But at times, I would run out. "One time a guy asked me, 'How long's it been since you've eaten?' And I said, 2 or 3 days, and he gave me a dollar, and I went to a cafe, and I first ordered the dinner, which was 30 or 35 cents, and when I got through, I was just as hungry as when I started. So I ordered a hot roast beef sandwich. And then I suddenly got sick, and I had to run out the door and throw up in the street. I wasted almost all of that dollar." Fear of living out his life on a farm had brought Morgan to San Marcos, and then to the university. But the fate he had feared loomed ahead of him now. He couldn't go on. "And then I heard, I don't remember how, that Lyndon was running the NYA. I had known Bill Deason, and I applied, and Bill said he would have to check with Lyndon. And the next day he called back and said, 'Are you ready to go to work?' And I said, 'Yes, sir, right now.' The next day he began working as an NYA project supervisor, a part-time job that allowed him to continue at law school, and that paid $65 per month. That was, he says, a big pile of money in those days. 'I don't believe,' he says, 'that I would ever have made it through law school without that particular job.' And he did not forget who had given it to him. After noting that he was very appreciative of Johnson's help, Morgan adds, 'I would have done anything within reason that he asked me to do.'" Morgan's poverty was not unusual. Many of the men who came to work as NYA executives were rescued from circumstances similarly desperate. and they felt as grateful as Morgan to their rescuer. In some cases, gratitude was reinforced by fear. Morgan could look forward to a law degree, a profession. Most of the men working beside him in the NYA offices had no such prospects. In fact, many natives of the hill country were all too aware that they might have difficulty finding any other job if they lost the high-paying, prestigious job Lyndon Johnson had given them. Their fear of losing it not only contributed to the energy with which they performed it, but made easier deference to the man who had given it, and who could take it away. Says one of them, who declined to give such deference, and who therefore did not make the team, "He knew he had them by the hairs because where else were they going to go? That's why he knew he could treat them like that, and they had to take it. And you know, once you start taking it, well, you get into the habit, you know, and habits get harder and harder to break. They got so used to taking his abuse that after a while they hardly knew they were taking it." Reinforcing gratitude and fear was ambition. Deason is not the only one of Lyndon Johnson's NYA boys who cites self-interest, sense enough to try to tie on, in explaining his allegiance to Johnson. Johnson played on their ambition, of course. His future was a frequent topic of the backyard discussions. "We knew he was going to run for something," Jones says. "And," says Jones, "you felt, knowing him, that whatever he ran for, he would win." "If he did," he assured them, "his victories would be theirs." They believed that, believed that when he had better jobs to give out, they would get them. So few paths out of poverty existed for a Texas farm boy then. These young men felt they were on one of those paths, perhaps the only one they would ever find, and they were eager to stay on it. But if gratitude and fear and ambition tied these men to Lyndon Johnson, there were other, less selfish ties. The chief made his boys feel like part of a team, almost like part of a family. "Well, now, let's play a while," he would say. Playing was done ensemble. Wives and babies would come with their husbands for backyard picnics, or they and the Johnsons would spend an afternoon picnicking and swimming at icy Barton Springs, or an evening nightclubbing in the Mexican cantinas of San Antonio. And he made them feel like part of history, too. During those long evenings in the backyard, he didn't merely read NYA regulations. He put them into perspective, an inspiring perspective, explaining how the NYA was trying to salvage the lives of young men and women who were walking the streets or riding the rails in despair, who were cold and hungry. "Look, fellas," he would say, "these rules are a lot of nonsense, but we have to follow them because we have to put the kids to work. We have to get them into school and keep them there, and we have to do it fast. We can't have Washington sending the forms back because we didn't fill them out right, because every day more of them drop out of school and we'll lose them forever. Put them to work. Get them into school," he would say. And as he spoke, his eyes, shining out of that pale face there in the dark, would reflect the glow of the flickering lanterns. "Put them to work! Get them out of the boxcars!" He lit in even the most stolid of his boys a sense of purpose that they remembered decades later, says the earnest Deason. "It was during the deep days of the Depression. We had a mission to get the young folks to work as fast as we could. Most of them found it impossible to resist the spell. You can't be around the guy without falling under his influence," Jones says, trying to explain. "First he fills himself up with knowledge, and then he pours out enthusiasm around him, and he can't stop him. I mean, there's no way. He just overwhelms you." If he drove men, he led them, too. Once, along the way to WPA certification of children whose families were on relief, and who were therefore eligible for NYA employment, arrived late on Friday afternoon. There were 8,000 names on the list, and Johnson told Deason and Morgan that he wanted those 8,000 teenagers at work on Monday morning. Morgan's first reaction was despair. The teenagers couldn't be contacted by mail over the weekend, and the NYA had already found that many teenagers didn't respond to letters anyway. Morgan, whose assignment at the time was nothing larger than supervising a roadside park, on which about 20 youths were employed, recalls that his first reaction was incredulity. But Johnson told him to take the 20 youths, divide up the 8,000 names among them, and have them spend the weekend going directly to the teenagers' homes to speak to them in person. "I got the kids in and stayed there almost until morning, dividing up the names among them by streets. I'd shout out an address on Guadalupe, and the kid who had Guadalupe would write it down. And Saturday morning, we hit the street. We didn't contact all of them, but on Monday morning, we had 5,600 of them down there, and we put them to work. That's the kind of assignments he'd give you that would seem nearly impossible. But he taught you you could do them. Cursing his men one moment, he removed the curse the next, with hugs. I saw him get angry at Sherman Birdwell one time, and he used most of the cuss words and combinations I had ever heard, Morgan says. And just as soon as he got through eating his ass out, he had his arms around him. And with compliments. Compliments which, if infrequent, were as extravagant as the curses. Remarks that a man repeated to his wife that night with pride, and that he never forgot. He made them feel needed. Mary Henderson recalls watching him in a crisis when he was absolutely frantic with worry. And she recalls that when the crisis was over, he said, "I have never been in need of people or been in trouble without looking around and finding your face." And he put his arm around me, and I was nobody. Oh, you wanted to please him more than anything. He joked with them. On a trip to Houston, he shared a hotel room with Mary's husband, Charles, Herbert Henderson's younger brother. During the night, Henderson was awakened by groans from the other bed. "Charlie! Charlie!" Johnson moaned. "I feel terrible. I need a drink of water." Henderson jumped up and ran to the bathroom. When he returned with the water, however, the light was on, and Johnson was sitting up in bed, smiling. The jokes had an edge. They were designed for the same purpose as the cursing, so that Johnson could display his dominance over his men. Henderson told his wife he understood that Johnson had moaned because he didn't want to have to get up and get the water himself. But the edge was honed differently for each man. Differently and precisely. Henderson didn't resent getting up for the water, or said he didn't. And Henderson's fellow workers didn't resent, or said they didn't resent, the jokes played on them. He gave each one of his boys a precisely measured dosage of cursing, of sarcasm, of hugging, of compliments, of exactly what was needed to keep them devoted to his aims. He was more than a reader of men, he was a master of men. And these men, the first on whom he had an opportunity to fully exercise his mastery, not only served him, but loved and idolized him. I knew that he would be moving into something with a bigger challenge, Deason says. I had a sense of destiny for him. When young Chuck Henderson had still been engaged to Mary, then a secretary back in Ashtabula, Ohio, he wrote to her, she says, "I'm working for the greatest guy in the world. Someday he's going to be President of the United States, and he's only 27 years old." Mary found this hard to believe, but when she arrived in Austin to get married, Lyndon Johnson was best man, and to become a secretary in the NYA offices, she saw at once why Chuck believed it. This book is continued on cassette number 6, side 1.